session of the House Education Committee will come to order. Welcome, everyone, and welcome, guests. Today, we're going to take our agenda somewhat out of order. First up today will be House Bill 2443, then House Bill 2070, followed and finishing with House Bill 2560. Thank you. We'll have a... open a public hearing on House Bill 2443. Mr. Keller, would you like to go over the bill with us?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2443, we first heard it in a public hearing on 221. This allows an employee of a school district or public charter school to serve on a district board if the district is small and the person is employed as a school bus driver. Declares an emergency effective on July 1, 2005.
Thank you. Representative Butler, do you have any further testimony in regard to this bill? Any questions in regard to this bill from the committee? Then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2443 and open a work session on House Bill 2443.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 2443 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dahlin moves House Bill 2443 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, then those of the opinion House Bill 2443 should be reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye, and those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Thank you. The motion, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and Representative Butler will be the carrier. Thank you. Now we will open a public...
Closer.
Pardon?
Go ahead and close your work session.
Oh, I thought I had hammered. The work session is closed on House Bill 2443. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2070. Mr. Keller, do you have anything to go over with us?
House Bill 2070 specifies that a child is a resident of a school district in which the child attends school for the purpose of receipt of state school fund monies by the district. Eliminates the exception for determining residency of a child with disabilities for purposes of attending school. Eliminates the option of school districts allowing a resident child to attend school in another district by contract that transfers school funds to the receiving district. Declares an emergency effective July 1, 2005. And as a subsequent referral to revenue, we have two individuals not here, but they will be testifying by phone, and we have representatives from the Department of Education in case we have any other additional questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be with you today. I'm House Representative Tom Butler from House District 60 in southeastern Oregon. House Bill 2070 comes to you after considerable work last session with some angst over some folks that felt like perhaps this provided the bill that we had last session provided too much latitude for folks to have choice within their school districts relative to moving students around. So we limited it this session to discuss just with regard to those students who have special needs and on IEPs that need to move around in order to get the education that are required. And so House Bill 2070, as your staff has indicated to you today, would authorize the student to move and basically follow, and that's why we bring this bill to you, is to follow wherever they need to go within their area to commute to a school that could serve their needs a little bit better. The instant case, and you'll be talking to Dennis Savage, the superintendent, and Harper, the instant case, we've got a student with an IEP who has followed Superintendent Savage represents lives in NISA, Oregon, and has been the superintendent in NISA, Oregon. Has a student that has followed him for special educational instruction out to Harper, which is probably some 50 miles distant on a commute basis, and Harper is a boarding school as well, so it's a 4 day a week school where people would commute out and be able to stay three nights, Monday night, Tuesday night, and Wednesday night, and finish up school and then head back into town. And in the instant case, the desire is that students who have these special needs, who seek either smaller school districts or school districts where they can get better service, in some cases even larger school districts, that the funds would follow the students for their specific needs. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Butler at this point? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Butler, in the background material, staff measure summary, I assume you have a copy of that.
I do not.
Okay. It says that the affected school district would be required to transfer the 50% of the school district's general purpose grant per ADMW to the Department of Education. And I'm trying to figure out whether that means that not all the money follows the student or there is a problem in the way the bill's crafted.
That would be the last sentence, Representative Butler.
Yeah, right at the bottom. And it's something that we can research, obviously, since it's new to you. That question's new to you.
Madam Chair, Representative March, that is a new question to me, and I just have to defer that back to staff. Again, the bill is written along the lines that Superintendent Savage helped me in discussing and preparing the bill. And it's an ongoing, it's a work in progress from last session as well.
Great.
Okay. I see Brian Reeder here from the Department of Education. Would you like to comment on that for us?
Chair Flores, members of the committee, this bill actually does three separate things. Senator Butler described one of them, which related to special education students when they are placed outside their home district. This bill would mean that they would be considered residents of the district in which they were placed rather than residents of the district in which their parents live, which is what the law currently says. The piece that you're talking about right now has to do with charter schools. Under charter school law in Oregon, in the case of an elementary charter school, the charter school is paid 80% of the per ADMW allocation to its district. The remaining 20% is split between, in cases where the student is a resident of another district, it is split between that student's resident district and the district where the charter school is located. This provision would eliminate that distribution to the district where the student lives. So it essentially keeps that entire 20% in the home district, the district where the charter school is located.
You probably muddied it now for me just a little bit. Since the figure here is transferring the 50% to the school district's general purpose grant per ADM to the Department of Education.
Chair Flores, if you, that is somewhat confusing language, and I'm trying to find it here myself. It's 50%
of the 20%.
It's half of that 20%. It's not 50% of the entire amount.
Okay.
Correct.
Let me just follow up then, Madam Chair. Since there's a third part of this bill now that we should also get clarification on.
Yes, Chair Flores, Representative March, on page 2, you will see some language being deleted starting on line 24 and up through line 34. That language was put in the law a number of years ago when we discovered that school districts were trading students back and forth from year to year to take advantage of the provision in the funding formula that funded a district on the higher of its current year or its prior year ADNW. So districts were trading students to so that their enrollment would be higher every other year. The way they did that was a student living in one district but attending school in the other, the two districts would, under a contract, arrange for the home district to get the money through the formula, count the student, and then pay the money to the attending district. In the following year, the district where the student was actually attending would claim the student in the formula under an inter-district agreement, and then that way they would trade them back and forth and get more money through the formula. This language was put in there to prevent that from happening. The third part of what this bill does is it eliminates the ability of districts to enter into those contracts. It says if you're going to have a student live in one district and attend in another, the only way you can do that is through an inter-district agreement. And so this, my understanding is that this language is no longer necessary because those trading agreements, those flopping back and forth of students would not be possible without the ability to do it by contract. So,
thank you.
Thank you. So, Mr. Reeder, it is preserving the inter-district agreement piece, eliminating language that's no longer relevant in regard to what has transpired.
That's my understanding of what this does, yes. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate Mr. Reeder's explanation of that. And here all of this time, I thought it was just dairy termination program on the farmers that could make the cows move around and make it appear like there was cows on one side of the road when they were all on the other side of the road. But I can see now that it was superintendents and school districts that figured that out, too.
Oh, maybe they had some creative accountants.
Perhaps that's so representative.
Are there additional questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lynn.
Yes, I'm not quite clear that in case of a charter school, 80% goes to the charter school student, and the 20% used to be divided by the school superintendent, school district, and also the Department of Education. Before, and now it's 20% goes to where?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, we have two types of charter schools in Oregon. One type is those sponsored by a school district, and in that case, the 20% will go to that school district.
Okay.
If the student lives in the same district in which the charter school is located. If the student lives in another district and comes to the charter school, under current law, that 20% would be split between the two districts.
Okay.
Part of it going back to the district where the student lives and the other half staying with the district where the charter school is located. This bill would eliminate the half going back to the district where the student lives and leave the entire 20% with the district where the charter school is located. The other kind of charter schools we have in Oregon are those sponsored by the state. And in those cases, that extra money would be, under current law, split between the home district of the student and the state as the sponsor. And again, this bill would eliminate the part going back to the home district, and all the money would remain with the department as the sponsor of the school. Excuse me, as a sponsor of the school.
So follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
I'm kind of slow guy, couldn't understand sometimes all of it. So 80% goes with the Unke charter school, goes to the follow the student. And then 20% stays where it is, or it doesn't follow the student?
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, correct. It does not follow the student to the charter school. It goes to the sponsor of the charter school, which is either a district.
So that's the state's 20% over there.
Or the state, correct.
Okay. So it might be then less beneficial to the student because they used to get a 10%. Now they don't get a 10%. The 50%, they don't get it.
Well, Chair Flores, Representative Lim, the 20% never followed the student to the charter school.
Yeah.
It went to either the sponsoring district or was split between the sponsoring district and the home district of the student.
Okay.
But it never went to the charter school.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Dahlem and then Representative Roblin.
With the 20%, what's that 20% for? The 20% that stays with the home school? Or is split? What's the money? What's the idea of the 20%?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, my understanding is that that provision was put into place under the assumption that the district would still be providing certain services to the charter school, you know, administrative, accounting, bookkeeping, a number of other things that the district would be providing to the charter school if the charter school was not big enough to really provide efficiently on its own.
Most of it, bookkeeping type things, keeping track of the ABM and that sort of thing.
That's my understanding.
And, how much, thank you, Madam Chair, follow-up question, please. When we talk in percentages, how much is 20% of the average ABM payment?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, the average formula payment per ADMW right now is something below $5,000. So, I mean, we tend to use $5,000 as a round figure. So 20% of that is $1,000.
So we keep $1,000 for administrative expense, is what it is.
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, you know, we don't keep it. It goes to the districts.
Whoever, yeah.
Yes.
That's the idea. Thank you very much.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. Isn't that also negotiable with the charter school, though? Aren't there some charter schools that get less than the 80 and other charter schools that can actually get more if the district so agrees?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, a lot of things are negotiable when you're talking about charter schools. What the law says is that they will get a minimum of 80%. And, you know, the reality is, though, that they can negotiate over which sorts of services the district will provide to the charter school. Some of them the district will provide for free. Others they will charge the charter school for. So there's a lot of flexibility, but the law says a minimum of 80% in the case of elementary schools and 95% in the case of high schools.
Right. Representative Farr.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just thought of this. In many cases, a student with disabilities has, well, in all cases in Oregon, has an individualized education plan. And so sometimes a school would spend a lot of time with that student identifying their special needs and providing the plan. And then that student is going to leave that school and go to a different school. So is that going to be costly in the long run? And do you know how many students this might affect?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I don't have data with me on the number of, are you specifically talking about charter schools, IEP students in charter schools?
No.
Or,
in general.
Oh, I see. Back to this mm-hmm. other provision of the bill. I don't know. It pertains only to IEP students who are placed in a facility in a district or a facility outside of their home district. And I don't know how many that is. I think it's probably a relatively small share of all special education students.
So follow up. So this, I don't understand, but this wouldn't allow students to leave the district that they're in and go to a different school district if they wanted to attend a different school.
No, Chair Flores, Representative Farr, it doesn't do that at all. Right now, the law says that a special education student is considered a resident of the district where their parent or guardian lives, unless they are placed in a facility outside their home, away from their parents, in another district. And in that case, they are considered a resident of the district where they've been placed. But current law also makes some exceptions that say, under these circumstances, they can be considered still a resident of where their parents live. What this bill does is eliminate those exceptions.
I see.
So it says, in all cases where a special education student is placed outside their home in another district, they will be considered a resident of that other district, not the district where their parents live. Essentially, it lets the money, the formula money, follow them to their new district in all cases rather than just in some cases.
Thank you for that clarification.
And Madam Chair, if I may, in extremely rural school districts, like the school districts that I represent in House District 60 and 58 and 59 are very similar. Many times those IEPs are worked up not necessarily wholly by the school district, but by the ESD, as it provides the resources, which is largely regional in its in their outreach. So it's not like someone has a great deal of money invested in them and they lose that investment for that student. We're looking for the best welfare and assistance to the student wherever they can get it, and when the family believes that that's in a little smaller school setting or a school setting that's more convenient for them to take their child to, or where they have the programs that are ideal for that child to be able to be addressed in, then it's community money that has been invested in the bringing that student to that particular point, that IEP.
Further questions? Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Reeder. And I think we'll proceed then, Mr. Butler, Representative Butler, with our teleconference testimony. Technical timeout.
Harper School, this is Karen.
Is Mr. Savage there?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for calling.
Jim Keller from the House Education Committee.
Thank you.
Hello, Mr. Savage. This is Linda Flores. I'm chair of the House Education Committee, and you're on speakerphone before the committee and an audience.
Good afternoon, Chair Flores.
Good afternoon, and if I might take a moment of personal privilege, I understand you are the brother of a very good friend of mine by the name of June Hartley.
That's correct. I'm her baby brother.
Well, you please give her my regards.
I'll be 65 in April.
And blessings on you. Mr. Savage, for the record, would you give us your name and where you're from, and then you may proceed to give us your input on House Bill 2070.
Good, Chair Flores. I would like to speak in support of House Bill 2070. First, I'd like to introduce myself to the House Education Committee. My name is Dennis W. Savage. I'm currently in my 39th year of working in the educational world. I've spent 9 years as a middle school teacher and coach, 9 years as an elementary principal of a 600-student body elementary school, 16 years as superintendent of a 1,200-student body school, K-12, and I'm currently in my fifth year with the Harper School District as a school superintendent principal. Harper is a small district containing 90 students, age K through 12. The high school has 36 students. Our average class size between 8 and 12. We are located 24 miles west of Vail, Oregon, which is the next closest school district. Several of our students are bused 15 to 20 miles north and west of Harper, which is even further from Vail. And we do have a dormitory that will hold a maximum of about 10 students. Several at-risk students from other school districts in Malheur County attend Harper. This is usually done on an inter-district agreement form signed between the two district school boards. Some parents feel that Harper may be the last chance they have to keep their sons and daughters from dropping out of school. Most of these students require a smaller class size or one-on-one help from the teacher. Because of this ability to provide personal attention to individual student needs, many participate in classroom discussions for the first time in their life. Almost all of these at-risk students participate in extracurricular activities for some for the first time also. In my 5 years at the Harper School District, we have encountered zero high school dropouts. In the past, when special education students in Malheur County attended another district, the student was reported as a resident of the attending school district, just like any other student was reported. To my personal knowledge, this was done for at least a 30-year period. About 2001-2002 school year, an employee from the Department of Ed and the Special Education Department contacted the Malheur County ESD information that this method of funding was incorrect, that special education funding or the second weight count may not be reported with the sending district. This means that approximately $5,000 for the special education needs of the students is sent to the district that the students live in instead of going to the district where the student is being educated. I have yet to talk to a parent that believes this is reasonable. I have yet to talk to a parent that believes this is fair. Currently, there are 5 IEP students, those which are not with an individual education program, attending the Harper School District on an inter-district agreement who were listed on the December 1, 2004 census of another district. The year before, there were 7. These other districts who provide nothing to the student but a signature report these students to the state and thereby may receive the second weight of approximately $5,000 a student. The resultant estimate of between $25,000 to $35,000 is a relatively large amount of money to a small school district. The only way for the attending school district to receive money for the special needs of the special education student is for the sending district to agree to a supplemental form that is on the inter-district agreement. To the best of my knowledge, no superintendent in Malheur County has ever signed a form would send either money or services to the attending district. It is usually presented to the parents in the form of what I would call blackmail situation. You are told, if the attending district won't furnish what you believe you need for your child, don't send him. Side note, with the 11% cap on special ed students, the child may or may not affect your school support funds. Attendants are very reluctant to send a certain amount of money when in reality they are over the 11% cap. The students themselves do not generate any additional money for the school. The concept of money following the student presented in House Bill 2070 is reasonable. I'm sure there are other counties where small school districts exist and provide the services that the Harper School District provides to at-risk students. In the fairness, equity, best interests of students and parents alike, I implore you to seriously consider House Bill 2070. I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you might have with me.
Thank you, Mr. Savage. I'm going to now inquire of the committee if there are any questions for you. Representative Dahlem, Vice Chair Dahlem, has a question for you.
Yes, Superintendent Savage. Would this be an at-will attendance? Mom and dad can simply take their child to your school and establish residence for the child. Is that at-will?
Chair Forrest, in response to Representative Dahlem's question, I would respond with no. There still has to be an inter-district agreement signed between the school districts. In Malheur County, we very well have an agreement among school districts that The superintendents will sign an inter-district agreement if it's presented to them from parents who wish their child to go to a different school district. I would assume this form would still have to be signed even though this bill were passed.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions for Superintendent Savage? Thank you very much, sir. We appreciate your time.
I appreciate the time to testify before the House Education Committee.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We have one more call, and that will be Ann Schimmer, who is also a superintendent. Of what school district? Do you know?
Yep. She's not a superintendent. She's a parent of a special ed child.
Correcting.
Is Ann there?
Yes, this is Ann.
And Jim Keller, House Education Committee.
Hi.
Hello, and this is Linda Flores. I'm chair of the House Education Committee, and we thank you for taking the time to give us some testimony today on House Bill 2070. So as you begin, would you please give us your name and for purposes of identification, and you can proceed to give your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Are you ready for me now?
We're ready for you now.
My name is Elizabeth Ann Schiemer, S-C-H-I-E-M-E-R. I reside in Ontario, Oregon, and my daughter goes to school at Harper School District in Harper, Oregon. My home phone number is 541-889-9018.
You may proceed. Thank you.
The reason that I am asking for your consideration of this bill is because of my daughter, Marissa Cage. She's 16 years old and has been on an IEP, individualized education program, since she was in kindergarten in the Ontario School District. She has ADHD, dyslexia, central auditory processing disorder, some limited hearing problems, and she just has not done well at all, mostly because she has a hard time reading. And by the time she got to junior high and she was still only reading, you know, about third grade level, we pulled her out of there and put her in a small little country school called Annex for 2 years, where she did so much better because of the limited number of children in the classroom. The self-esteem of the children is better. They get more time with their teachers, and it's just a better atmosphere for them. But her money didn't follow from Ontario, and every time they wanted to get something outside of their own budget, it was being denied. At the end of the eighth grade, because they don't go to high school, I have a friend that suggested we go to Harper, which has been a godsend to us. Dennis and his instructors are wonderful. Katie, her self-esteem is so much higher. She actually talks to people. She is in activities out there. It's wonderful. For any children who have learning disabilities, I highly recommend finding a small school district where you get the extra care. Every child gets extra care, not just ones that come into it from the outside. But every time that they have had to go to the Ontario School District with something special, because of her dyslexia, we were trying to get some special tutoring for her to see if a dyslexic certified teacher would help her, whereas just a teacher with no direct background in dyslexia had been able to take care of her. As a junior in high school, she's reading, I believe, not quite the fifth grade level, and that's not going to get her very far in the outside world. And it's been denied and denied and denied. I've even actually been told by their director, you know, when I've asked, well, what happens to the money that's designated for my daughter when it doesn't come to her? Well, we put it back in the general fund for some other child. That's not right. And it's not right that another school district is telling her school district now that she can't have those funds simply because she moved beyond that school district because they could not give her what she needed. The large classrooms in Ontario, as well as any large school, do not work well with children who have learning disabilities, and the smaller schools do. And every time to be denied doesn't help things, because and they have so much control over them. And at one point, even Harper School District said, Ann, we'll donate the $1,000 to get her tutored and we'll, out of our own funds. And that isn't right either. I don't pay taxes into that school district, and it's through their generosity that my daughter is allowed to go to school there. They deserve to have those funds so that she can get the special education that she deserves and needs. And that's what Dennis Savage is trying to get done. Make sure that those funds follow the child so we're not always asking for them and being denied. And I've had to file due processes to try to get things done. And that's not right. He deserves to have the right to, you know, to have those funds so that we can get the education she needs without being told, well, since you can't get what you want at that school you moved to, then you're going to have to come back and homeschool. We left the homeschool in the beginning because they could not service my child's needs. She doesn't need to be blackmailed to be brought back into it. And that's what we hope to get done. And it's not just my child.
Thank you. Will you... I'm going to ask the committee if there are any questions for you, if you're willing to answer those.
Sure.
Are there any questions for Ms. Shimer?
Shimer.
I'm sorry for the mispronunciation.
No, that's fine.
There are no questions. Thank you. We're very thorough, and we appreciate you taking the time to give us your input.
Well, I appreciate your calling me, Chairman Flores, and I hope that something can be done, because this is not just my daughter. It's not my school district. It's statewide, and there are a lot of schools that and children who would benefit from it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have a good day.
Thank you. You too.
Okay.
We have one last person to provide testimony, and that would be Peter Tarzian.
Tarzian,
I apologize. And Mr. Tarzian, as you begin, if you would please give us your name for the record.
Okay, I will do that. My name is Peter Tarzian. I'm superintendent of schools at the Falls City School District in Polk County. Falls City School District is a small school district and a rural school district. I'm also chair of the Oregon Small Schools Association Legislative Action Committee. I'm having passed out some testimony that that's been prepared today. I was interested in listening to the testimony from Eastern Oregon because some of those schools are, in fact, our members. It isn't my intention to either oppose or support the bill at the current time, but I did want to provide a little additional information, which I've provided for you in front of you. There's really four points that I would like to make. For a number of small school districts related to special education funds, many of us have agreements with other school districts where we work out how to cause the money that we collect for the what's commonly called the second basic actually follow the child. The arrangement that I have at the Dallas School District, where we exchange a number of students, some of them special education, is in any particular year that I am reimbursed for special education students, whatever percentage I'm reimbursed for that second basic, and it never is 100% above the 11% cap. That particular percentage I then send to the Dallas School District, and the Dallas School District does the same. And so I understand that there are some real concerns, or at least I learned a few minutes ago, from patrons and school districts in Eastern Oregon where maybe they don't have as quite a well-worked-out arrangement that we have worked out here. I'm really not going to comment on that. What I really do want to point out, though, is the place where we have problems with the law in Falls City and a number of other school districts is how we determine residency of the student. What you have in districts that you have a small district or a large district, and there's cross-population. Sometimes family members live in one side of the line and other family members live in the other. We're concerned in particular about maintaining or even clarifying how a student's residency is determined. There's two AG opinions that the Department of Education currently uses. related to persons in parental responsibility, guardianship, and actual parents. That would be an important piece to make sure that occurs in any kind of statutory change that you make to the current law. Another point that I would like to make is that there is a practice sometimes that occurs where school districts basically don't ask for any kind of evidence on the part of parents of where they actually live. And so, consequently, districts are collecting for students whose parents actually do not reside, you know, in that school district. That needs to be also something that needs to be looked at, you know, as you consider statutory changes in the law. And then I guess the last point that I'd like to make is and that's in relationship to charter schools. Chair Flores, Representative Lim, I think I heard you ask some questions about charter schools. Currently, I do collect half of that 20% that's left for the administrating publicly chartering school district. And so in that case, that would be Dallas School District. I have a Lucky Mute charter school in my area. It's in the Dallas School District. Currently, I have no way in which to place any kind of restrictions on the number of students that are transferred from my school district to the charter school. Not that I particularly care to put any restrictions on it, but the point is that the Dallas School District, on the other hand, does have the ability to do that with its charter. And so I would hope that you would consider trying to level the playing field a little bit there. Those are my comments, and any questions you have, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Tarzian? Representative Roblin, and then Representative Dahlen.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just ask a quick question. This one indicates that, you know, going from a bigger district to a smaller district kind of in this scenario, but I could also see the scenario where a large district has a lot of programs for special education students, and they choose to just leave the small district and go to the larger district. Would that, in your opinion, cause a hardship on the smaller districts if there are a number of their students choosing to leave and the money would follow them, so you would have nothing for those?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, yes, it would. In my particular case, I have probably more special education teachers per capita students than, in fact, my friends in Dallas do. As a matter of fact, there's a kind of a reverse reaction now to the state school funding crisis, where I actually am beginning to see increased enrollment because parents are choosing smaller class sizes and more intimate services that I can offer at the Fall City School District.
Representative, okay, we addressed that. Thank you, Dr. Tarzian.
Thank you, Chair Flores, for giving me an opportunity to address the committee. Thank you.
This House Bill 2070 was scheduled for public hearing only today, and we will be interested in seeing the Attorney General's opinion upon which some of these considerations have been made as presented by Dr. Tarzian. So, and we'll be providing that information to Representative Butler as well. So we will, thank you, adjourn the public hearing on House Bill 2070. We'll close our file, and we'll move forward. Mr. Keller, House Bill 2560.
Ms. Pham, House Bill 2560 establishes the Portland State University as a public corporation under the control of the Portland Metropolitan University's Board of Directors. Removes Portland State University from the Oregon University System, changes the name of the Oregon Health and Science University Board to Portland Metropolitan University Board of Directors, becomes operative on July 1, 2006, and has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Greenlick, it appears we've drawn a crowd. Would you please come forward and speak to your bill?
All the supporters, I'm sure. Madam Chair, thank you. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. And I really appreciate the opportunity to address the committee on the matters that of House Bill 2560, co-sponsored by myself and by the Chair. First, I'd like to give you a little of my background because it's relevant to where this bill came from and where my perspective is on this bill. I came to Portland in 1964 to start a research center for Kaiser Permanente, which I headed and became Vice President of Research for more than 32 years for Kaiser Permanente. And in that position, I knew that the future of research in the area really depended on strengthening the universities with which I became involved over the next 40 years. In 1965, I became a faculty member of what was then Portland State College. It became Portland State University at some later date, and remained a faculty member for about 30 years. I taught a class a quarter, usually without pay, during that time period across a variety of fields. Got the first grant for a PhD program at Portland State in health services and the urban studies program. Helped form the urban studies program, involved in a variety of ways. I continue to be involved in that university. I sit on the Institute of Portland Metropolitan Studies Board of Directors. I'm on the Advisory Committee for the Judaic Studies Program, and I actively participate in research with a variety of faculty at Portland State. I also became involved in Oregon Health Sciences University about the same time, remained as a clinical faculty for many years, developed research projects there, taught classes there, did lectures there, and in 1990 became chair of the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Oregon Health Sciences University, a position I served in for 10 years as an academic administrator in that university. Started the three-university program, Masters of Public Health program between Oregon State, PSU, and OHSU. Created the Oregon Health Policy Institute that was a multi-institutional organization. Moved the Department of Public Health and Preventive Medicine from basically a dormant state to the third largest department in the United States in that area and medical schools anywhere. I state this because I want to make it clear that the reason I'm here with this proposal is because I love these two institutions. I've been very committed to them for this whole period. I've been committed to them far more years than most of the faculty that remain in those institutions. And I've had a chance to observe how the education system, the higher ed system in the Portland metropolitan area, works. It's been obvious to me for a long time that this integration is the only way that higher education can be moved forward in the Portland metropolitan area. But it became much clearer to me how critical that issue was, not only for a perspective of excellence in educational programming in the area, but for a question of economic development in the metropolitan area. I sat in the year 2000 in a meeting on the West Side Economic Summit, talking about the potential for higher ed in the Portland metropolitan area. And in that meeting, the speaker, an economist, Joe Courtwright, was talking to the barriers of economic development in the Portland metropolitan area. And one of the barriers was the fact that Portland, Oregon, didn't have a major institution. In fact, he referred to it in his verbal comments as a Tier 4 university, when you considered Portland State as the university of the metropolitan area. And he went on to say that whenever you looked at the cities, the metropolitan areas that Portland was going to be competing with over the next 25 years in terms of the world economy and in terms of bringing the kinds of industry to Oregon that we need to bring to Oregon. We were always suffering from the fact that if we were talking about San Jose, there was Stanford. If we were talking about L.A., there was UCLA. If we were talking about Dallas, there was a set of comprehensive integrated universities. Austin, there was the University of Texas. Boston, there was Harvard and MIT. Toronto, there was the University of Toronto. Montreal, there was McGill and the University of Montreal. Vancouver, British Columbia, there was UBC. Everywhere you went, there was a integrated, comprehensive university that could produce the ideas, the innovation, and the workers for supporting economic development in that area. Where is Portland in that? Well, in starting to look at this question, I began to think about what had happened with the development of Virginia Commonwealth University. That was a university developed in Richmond with a very similar combination of Virginia Polytechnic Institute and the Virginia Medical College. When I went to the website for that university, I found on the website an article about how Virginia Commonwealth University was in the top 200 universities in the world. And I went to that ranking system. I have the top 500 universities in the world in this book that I got off the website on that ranking. And what did I find? Well, I found Oregon State was ranked between 100 and 150 in the world. The top 10 were the ones you all know, you know, Harvard, Stanford, just what you'd expect. University of Michigan, my alma mater, although University of Washington was 10 on that. But Oregon State was between 100 and 150. OHSU was ranked in there, and it was between 150 and 200. University of Oregon was ranked between 200 and 300, and this was in terms of science, technology, education, the production of innovation. And Portland State wasn't in that 500 at all. It wasn't ranked. Who was in that bottom tier of 100? University of Wyoming, University of Idaho, Montana State University. I mean, here's we're depending on the future of this metropolitan area on an institution that can't get ranked in the same class as the University of Wyoming. But, and if you want to see how this actually works out, there was an Oregonian article that really looked at it, which sort of describes my vision. If you look at the second page of the testimony I passed out, you'll see Oregon, some Oregon and Washington universities ranked based on their research money and the number of students they have. This comes from the Lessons from Washington, a study in higher ed success in the Oregonian 2 weeks ago, a front page article in the Oregonian. And if you look at Portland State, down at the bottom, with $30 million of research a year, 18,000 students, it basically gets lost in the kind of economic development discussions that happen when you're talking about world-class universities. But when you look at what would happen when you combine those institutions just in terms of numbers alone, what you find is the Portland Metropolitan Universities, which is what I call the board, although not necessarily the university, when you combine them, the university that's created, the one industries would be looking at when they looked at the Portland area to find out what was the educational opportunity, the institution has about $300 million a year in research, in the combined research, and over 20,000 students. It doesn't approach University of Washington, which with nearly $1 billion, but it does have twice the research output that Washington State has, even with their two campuses. Well more than twice the output that Oregon State has. Three or four times the output that the University of Oregon has. It really creates a substantial university, one that has the appearance of strength as well as real strength. The truth is, and you have other articles that I've given you that you might find interesting, that the editorial from last Sunday's Oregonian, the lead editorial, suggesting this idea has merit, a long story in the Portland Business Journal from 3 weeks ago. But the point's not numbers, and the point's not reflected glory. What the point is that if we move forward to create this university, the vision I have of where education in the metropolitan area can be is an institution that is a that has the real opportunity for excellence. These two institutions are almost entirely complementary. If you put the engineering program from Portland State, which does a wonderful job of producing bachelor students, together with the OHSU program that came from the OGI merger, semi-ill-fated OGI merger, you have an engineering school that produces bachelors, masters, and PhDs and creates a critical mass to move forward. Intel said in the summit of the state that they were now importing 100% of all the PhD people they brought to Oregon, 80% of all the master's people, and 50% of all the bachelor's people. This engineering school, combined that way, could move forward into the 21st century. You put the two programs of public health together, and you have a school of public health that ranks with any school of public health. And this goes, you'll hear from some faculty from Portland State who'll tell you how this works in basic sciences and life sciences today. But the fact is, we need to merge these institutions to create the kind of critical mass that can move us forward. Portland State's had an excellent system science program and a math department, but they've been very weak on the statistics side, and statistics is vital for moving forward in health sciences research and a variety of other research. We have more than 15 full-time PhD biostatisticians at OHSU. You combine these two and you have a program of math and statistics that allows us to compete with anybody. It allows us to compete with anybody in the United States in moving the kind of new industries, emerging industries we want in this state, and it allows you the opportunity, the critical mass, to educate students in a way that can't possibly be educated dealing with the institutional barriers of having these two institutions separately, even though we've worked very hard to find individual collaborative programs. I have a very simple solution for how to move these institutions. Bill, you have in front of you is pages and pages long, but most of it is boilerplate, changing statutes for anywhere OHSU is mentioned or PSU is mentioned. The heart of the proposal is a very simple proposal. It simply takes PSU out of the state system of higher education for business purposes, just as OHSU moved out nearly 10 years ago. Expands the public corporation board that now manages OHSU, puts enough people on it to deal with this, the notion of a complex university, a comprehensive university, and runs both these two institutions as parallel institutions under the leadership of that single expanded board. It then gives the board a decade to create that integration plan, to move these two institutions into a single integrated comprehensive university in a pragmatic, incremental way, in a way that makes sense to that board as they look at the problems they seek. It's a very simple and pragmatic model. You're going to hear a set of objections to this. I've been asked, what do the universities think about it? You'll hear what the universities think, but mostly what I've heard is that the presidents of the two institutions aren't really very crazy about this. That's probably not a surprise. In fact, one of the barriers to eventual coordination of these two is this kind of an attitude, the attitude that we're fine, we're doing just fine the way we are, don't worry about what the community needs, we'll take care of things. OHSU, we're fine, we're doing what we need to do. We can't take the time at this moment to figure out how to create the kind of institution that will serve the community. Those institutional barriers pervade, even for somebody who's worked for 4 years trying to create integrated programs across these two institutions. That barrier gets in the way. And it's simple questions like, where does indirect cost share go when you do cooperative research, to much more complicated questions like, can I get promoted in my department if I'm spending my time at the other university? Those are real universities that are real university problems that are created by the territorial boundaries we have. You'll hear that this is a precipitous plan, that nobody's been had a chance to think about this. I first broached this plan with the presidents of both universities and their staffs in the year 2000, nearly five years ago. When I asked both of them what they thought of this plan and would they work with me to try and create a solution, the answer was no, it's a bad idea. It actually was mostly a bunch of jokes about where would the football team go and a variety of other nonsense. They refused to take this seriously. I tried to meet, for example, with the faculty senate of PSU and couldn't get until the first meeting that I'd been able to arrange to talk about this plan with faculty and staff at PSU, other than all my one-to-one contacts, was this week, because it all of a sudden became obvious to the leadership of the two universities that it was time to have a real debate. You'll now probably hear that we need five more years to think about what to do with it. Well, the fact is, I don't believe that's the case. I believe we need to move this. If we're going to get to the kind of vision that I hope you'll share with me about the kind of an institution that can serve this area and this state, that can move us forward, the answer is we need to start now. We need to begin to figure out how to do it now. We need to take simple, incremental, pragmatic steps to move this forward now. I've talked to faculty from both universities over these past 4 years, one at a time, and I find questions about what would it mean for me, what would it mean for my union contract, what would it mean for X, Y, or Z, questions, but generally speaking, intrigued with the notion that they could begin joining with their colleagues up on the hill or down in the flats to create the kind of educational program, kind of excellence in education that they need. You'll hear about the fact that these are two different cultures, but anybody who's ever been in a university knows that a university is a structure that allows a set of multiple subcultures. The medical school at Michigan had a culture that was very different from the School of Public Health, that had a culture that was very different from the graduate school. I was involved with all three of those schools. The same thing was true at Wayne State University, a university that where I got my bachelor's and my master's degree, an urban university that was Wayne University when I first started it in 1952 as an undergraduate. It was not a state university at that time. It had a very similar heritage. It now has 40,000 students. It's got a renowned medical school. If you read an article in the paper today about the most recent article on the use of estrogens, it was headed by a very well-known scientist at the medical school at Wayne State University. The culture of the medical school at Wayne State is different than the culture of the pharmacy school where I was, or the culture of the Lick School. But what a university does is it allows that kind of subcultures of different kinds of subunits to work together in a harmonious way to achieve overall objectives of the institution. I'll stop there and I'll take questions, and I hope you'll ask me any questions about this wacky idea that you have.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Questions? Representative Roblin?
Actually, I have a couple, so I hope other people have them. I guess my first question has to do with funding, because I watched OHSU have a cut this year from the governor's budget of $33 million, and I worry about putting these two groups together. What's going to happen, in your opinion, funding for this new entity?
Okay. Well, I'm going to have a bill I suspect you'll be seeing on funding the the health science educations in Oregon in a very different way. I mean, it was intriguing to me. Portland State announced in the paper this week that they were talking about creating a health professional education program with their traditional allies, Clackamas Community College and the Oregon Institute of Technology. It never occurred to them, because of these institutional barriers, that OHSU might have something to help in terms of health professional education. But there was confusion about what the deal was on how to fund OHSU when OHSU moved out of the system of higher education. You'll have the provost of that university here today, and you can ask about that. I'm working with OHSU to create a method of state support for the institution based on a certain percentage of the full cost of educating Oregon residents in the medical school, the nursing school, the dental school, and other health sciences professions on the Hill. I think it's time we fund the universities based on their educational product. We'll also be funding both of them, I suspect, in terms of special projects, and you'll hear things about the way OCED needs to go and how we can create innovation at the universities, and you'll be hearing bills on that, I think, in this committee. I think we need to look at how we fund education generally. My assumption is that OUS has begun moving its funding to a student-based model, particularly for Oregon resident students. I believe that will continue in the state's universities, and I think we need to create a more rational way to fund health professional education for our residents receiving their education in our university.
Follow up.
Along that same line, 10-year program to merge the two schools. Is there any funding in the bill itself to get groups of people together during that time to cause this to happen?
No, there is not special funding. Both universities have funding now. I think when you think of the financial impact of this, one of the things that's real downstream is, while the universities are both complementary, they also have two complete chains of administrative command. There are two presidents. It's possible that a university might only need one president. I'm sure that has nothing to do with the objection of the presidents here, but the university has two provosts. A future university will need one provost. The universities have two vice presidents for finance. A university might only need one vice president for finance. The universities have two registrars. It's possible that one university could need one registrar. Basically, downstream, there's enormous potential of administrative savings in the management of a single institution. I'm sure that has nothing to do with why the two provosts are going to be here objecting to it, because they're both people that can find a job anywhere, so that's not the issue. But the fact is, what we need to do is find out how to get from here to there, and that's what your question is. What makes this completely feasible is when OHSU moved out of the state system. I was an academic manager in OHSU at that time, and we received such almost instant efficiencies by moving out of what, by any measure, are totally awkward and inefficient management structures of OUS. We did need to create a set of new systems. That was expensive. It was incremental. We did it a little bit at a time, but we needed to create a payroll system, a human resource system generally, a purchasing system. OHSU has those systems available now, and they can be easily morphed to the new institution. And it doesn't have to leave OUS instantly. It can move out, even though it's under the new board, and I believe that the intermediate term efficiencies will pay for themselves very, very quickly by being in a much more flexible and efficient operation.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenlick, it appears that if your plan comes to fruition, that the university, whatever we decide to call it,
right,
would benefit
Farr
from
University.
That sounds great. Especially since my daughter may attend Portland State. Mm-hmm. But in leading up to the comment class slash question that I wanted to make. They would benefit from so much grant money for research that would offset any additional costs that they would have to incur to merge. Isn't that correct?
I really do think that's true. I think the universities continue to tell us that research costs them 10% for every, costs them 10 cents extra for every dollar they get. On the other hand, if OHSU had to give up its $260 million in research, it wouldn't be much of an institution. The fact is, I ran a department with an MPH program that graduated more than 100 people in its first few years with very, very little academic money. I funded most of my faculty as researchers who spent a marginal proportion of their time. Extremely highly qualified people that couldn't have come there, nor could I have paid them to come there just to be a teacher. Those were the teachers that taught those students. The increased ability to work together to get research to bring in the kind of faculty that your daughter will need to have, certainly at least in the upper division times, really will be extraordinarily advantaged by this program. Furthermore, Portland State now serves as a major feeding ground both for the nursing school and the medical school at OHSU, and that transition would be very much facilitated by being in a single institution.
Follow up.
So if I understand you correctly, the research money would also enable you to hire a higher caliber of faculty to teach at the university.
One of the huge problems right now in all of our three universities is that because of the way the state has starved the university, faculty salaries are very, very low in this university compared to other places. We work hard to recruit people. But one of the ways we recruit people, at least in the sciences and the social sciences, is by allowing them to be recruited on a soft money rather than a hard money basis. So we can pay them higher salaries if they do clinical work on the one hand or research work on the other. That can be far more expanded, I think, into the institutions to allow bringing really star quality scientists, as we've been able to do, in fact, in both places. But this would really augment that, I think.
Representative Roblin.
Two quick questions, if I can.
They always are.
Okay. Representative Greenlake, along that line, I just want to ask a cautionary question, and I because you have run these, you know, I have a son-in-law's a doctoral student at USC in a geomorphology, and they get a lot of grants, but the grants are pretty specific as to what you can use them for, and there's not a lot of other money to do some of those things. So, I mean, I caution people to think that the grant money, and I guess I've been asking you, grant money has specific uses, and to carry it over to other kinds of uses to fund regular program is not one of those generally.
Well, that's not the point.
Okay. I know I understand.
I spent my life managing grant money, so I know, you know, and I've managed to stay out of jail. I've never had a problem in an audit anywhere along the line. But what having these kind of grants doing is it allows you to bring student assistants in so that a representative's far daughter could have a work-study job that can be paid for on a grant. It allows you to fund somebody 80% time on a grant and 20% time in a teaching position. And it gives you so much more flexibility in managing an academic institution that you don't have without that kind of grant money. You cannot pay somebody 100% on a grant and then expect them to teach 50% time. There have been a lot of universities around the country that have done that, and it's gotten them into deep doo-doo.
That's the official term.
That's the official term. That's a term of art in the research field.
The other question, and I asked this one, the second one, in deference to my wife. I was the University of Washington graduate in math. Okay, and so I was the math person. She was the art person. Portland State is a university that has fine arts, actually, and liberal arts. And OHSU is mostly an engineering science medical school. It changes the tenor, and you talked a little bit about it in your opening comments, but I guess the concern I have is that it appears that you're trying to form a technical school in a sense, and so part of that other part, the fine arts part, will take a second seat as I look at this and as I've heard your testimony. And I mentioned that in deference. I was the science person. I like the science. I understand that part of it.
But my assumption, Representative Roland, is that your wife went to the University of Washington as well.
She did not.
Well, but she could have. They have an extraordinary arts program, an extraordinary fine arts program, extraordinary ancient language program. They're the one with $1 billion in research. So, I mean, what you've seen at that institution, because it's an integrated comprehensive university, is even though it has $1 billion in research, it has a remarkable undergraduate program. It has a remarkable lit school. They have very different cultures. My guess is half of that $1 billion is in the medical school. There, I mean, it's a very powerful institution and a wonderful school of medicine, but it's allowed this integrated comprehensive university to flourish across a lot of different fields because it has a kind of stature. It can recruit faculty, it can recruit donors to support these other programs. It's, you know, it's not just that it has a good football team. It's the excellence in faculty and in research that allows all these programs to flourish in the kind of university you went to and I went to at the University of Michigan and your son, did you say, is going to at USC.
Son-in-law, yeah.
Which also has a high power medical school.
Representative Dahl.
Yes, Representative Greenman, from the other end of the educational spectrum. Public education, but I want to ask a question. I'm making some assumptions here. I want to be sure that they're correct. Good universities get good grants. Great universities get great grants. Is that correct?
That's the point.
Thank you.
Representative March?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Greenlick, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I know you truly have a vision here, and you kindly supported my vision last session of creating a task force around Portland State University and looking at how we fund higher education in the urban area. And so, you know, I know it's something that you've really, really put your heart and soul in, and that's why I joined with you on this bill, even though I think we probably have slightly different vision of how we get to that end goal. And maybe the end goal is this marriage, but my sort of vision was that we build Portland State as a separate entity first, and then it was a more of a marriage of equals. But you're rather, I guess, almost a shotgun marriage here, but given a 10-year courtship, the pieces that I think are missing, and maybe they were missing last session too, is how this fits in with the rest of the education system and the economic system in the Portland metropolitan area, and how we integrate with the community colleges, and how we put that all together. And I wonder, you know, I always hesitate to suggest a study, but would you consider a study where we brought in the faculties, maybe representatives of faculty senates and representatives of the community colleges and the major economic engine folks, and brought them together and study this? I mean, you, as the president of the Senate, would call you a certifiably smart person, and but there are a lot of certifiably smart people out there that we could pull together and maybe come up with even a more creative and grander vision. Do you have any ideas on that?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, I strongly urged a study in the last session. I supported you. I presented another bill with the chancellor. When I met with the chancellor last time, not the current chancellor, but the past chancellor, well, he said he wasn't willing to support this right now because he didn't want to preside over the dismemberment of the OUS in his first year here. He knew that if he didn't have a plan for higher ed in the Portland metropolitan area, he didn't have a plan for higher ed. So I proposed with the chancellor a bill for a task force to look at the question of higher ed in the Portland area. I've come to believe that that would simply delay things beyond what needs to be delayed. I've tried hard to think of alternatives, and we do absolutely do think this doesn't include how we link with community colleges, which is very important. It also doesn't link, incidentally, include how we link with the private universities. When I first talked to Mark Hatfield about this plan, his first suggestion was to bring Lewis and Clark into it as a partner. I figured that was a little bit more than we could take on in the legislature, but the fact is this comprehensive university ought to have a law school, and there is one at Lewis and Clark. I don't believe that this is a slam dunk, but I do believe that this is a very high probability for the way to model where I want to go. I think if we agree with the vision that this institution, I mean, that this area needs a comprehensive, integrated, full-service university that can compete in the world, I try and imagine a variety of ways to go there. I imagine, for example, we close Oregon State, tear down the buildings in Corvallis and build it out in Washington County or in Clackamas County here.
Clackamas County, thank you very much.
Clackamas County. That's obviously not feasible. It's not feasible from an economic basis, and it's not feasible from a culture basis. You know, we have 100 years of people that have graduated from that institution. I think we need to move ahead, and I think where we need to move ahead is with the first step. I think if we create the board with two universities and charge them with maximizing the effectiveness of those two universities, and to think about a decade of planning for creating a single university, it's a very pragmatic model. Could it fail? Could it require a divorce? Yeah, it could. Is there any other way that I can imagine getting there? No, there isn't. And I think at this point, with the momentum I think we need to know, we need to be nimble. We need to move. We need to be prepared to somehow compete with all these other cities. And if we plan an interim study now, think about it in the next legislature. We're at least 2 and maybe 4 years behind even step one. So what I'm arguing for is step one. It could create some dislocations. It could be a little bit of a problem. It could make administrators uncomfortable because they have to do something different than what they plan on doing. But I think we need to move forward in this direction. If that board and the people they can bring to bear in that board can't figure out how to create it over 10 years, I don't see either university as being any worse off than they are now. So I say let's move.
Representative Greenlick, I would like to preserve some time for those folks who have come to testify either on either side of the discussion, but I wonder if you could briefly address some of the points that were raised in the article that you referenced, which was in the Oregonian, about the University of Washington economic impact in that area and perhaps the potential.
I can. We are never going to be the University of Washington. We're too far behind the curve. There's too much accident of history that started there. The state has made an extraordinary commitment to those institutions and poured money into both Washington and Washington State. And Microsoft is there, and Boeing was there, although I guess Boeing's not there anymore. That's created an enormous head start, and we're never going to catch them. They're 10th in the world right now by the ranking we have. However, we can move over time to create an engine that will serve far more effectively the economic development of this area. We start by creating a $300 million university, but that university in terms of research could move to 500 or 600. It could move us, I believe, into the top 100 universities in the world as we move, because we can create the critical mass. The economic development of this region requires us having an institution like that. Every article that you read says that. They don't all say this is the only way to get there, but I think this begins us moving toward the kind of economic engine we need for the metro area.
Thank you. One last question. Representative Lynn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe if this happens in 10 years, I'd like to propose that the university should be called the Green Lake and Flores University.
Maybe we could have a building.
And my question is, the representative Green Lake, you mentioned you try to talk to or talk to the president of both universities, and then they are opposing and this merger, if you call it, and I don't believe they are opposing it to keep their job.
But no, they're not.
But if that is not the case, did they give you any reason why they are not supporting this and instead of opposing of this merger? What's the logic behind it?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, first let me say that I have extraordinary respect, you know, you heard me joke, I have extraordinary respect for both those presidents and for both the provosts who you're going to be hearing today. They're both friends of mine. And I've had no problem talking to them. I talk to them far more than I want to. I'm very fond of them, and I respect them enormously, both of them. They've both done an incredible job. I think there's nobody in the world that could have done the job Peter Kohler's done on moving OHSU from where it was to where it is now. It's been quite extraordinary. And President Bernstein has done just a fantastic job creating an urban focus in that university. You'll hear the provost talk about some of the accomplishments, and their accomplishments of which we can all be proud. I think there's a normal inertia. President Kohler has really critical tasks in front of him, and what he says to me, and he says it honestly, is he's got enough on his mind just trying to make the South Waterfront work, just trying to move the university into the top 25 medical schools in research. President Bernstein says the same thing. They have a lot on their plate, and they frankly don't want their agendas that they've crafted very carefully over years to become disruptive by this, and this is a disruptive influence on it. I try to urge them both to think about the future and to think about the monument they could make to the future of the state by creating this kind of institution. But I think that's my opinion, and you can ask both of the provosts.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. And I know that there were a couple more questions, but I will promise you we'll return this for an additional public hearing, Representative Greenlick, so that we can address some of those remaining questions and yet not erode the time that we have for these others here to testify.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you so much for hearing this bill and for giving me the opportunity to talk to you.
Thank you. Yeah. I would like to call forward Dr. Michael Reardon from PSU and Dr. Leslie Halleck from OHSU.
Wish they're already together.
Well, you know, I've kind of seen them linked that way in the recent press accounts.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck. I'm the provost at Oregon Health and Science University. And indeed, we have often been linked in various activities over the past couple of decades, really. On behalf of OHSU, we applaud the goal of strengthening higher education in the Portland area. And that intent is clearly at the heart of this House Bill 2560. The bill's chief sponsor, Representative Greenlick, is a good friend of the institution. You heard his testimony to that effect. He's a member of our faculty. He was one of the driving forces behind a very creative venture that culminated in a joint master of public health between three universities, Oregon State, Portland State, and OHSU. It was so innovative that the accrediting visit, which I recall very vividly, said, "You can't do this. How on earth do you all get along so cooperatively?" And it's now in the top 10 in the country. So, and his force of will, which you've just witnessed, is really a large part of how that program came into being. unfortunately, we are very concerned that the approach embodied in this bill may not accomplish that goal of strengthening OHSU and PSU and the metropolitan area the way it's described. Some of our testimony was forecast because we respect Representative Greenlick and gave him our testimony beforehand so that he could see what we were going to say. In contrast to a couple of things that he said, this has been looked at approximately once a decade. Both Senates went through this in some detail in the 90s. It probably precedes his time certainly in his current role, and concluded that it was unworkable. Now, I don't know that that's a valid conclusion. I'm not here to tell you it was. It was a decade ago. But I think it's important to have some additional information. The transformation to a public corporation has been very successful for OHSU. That clearly is the impetus behind this legislation. The framework of the bill, in fact, is the public corporation bill. As you know, the HB 2560 would make Portland State a public corporation and merge it with OHSU under the auspices of this new governing board, which is in essence like our governing board. I would defer to officials at PSU on the desirability of becoming a public corporation from their perspective. But with respect to a potential merger, I think it's incredibly important for this group to understand how different the two institutions are. And we think those differences might prove irreconcilable, particularly in the absence of significant additional investment. The cultures of the two institutions are fundamentally different. OHSU is organized around a very decentralized set of governance structures in professional schools. You recall we were schools of the University of Oregon in Eugene until 1974, and because of that distance, that sort of decentralization evolved. It makes a certain amount of sense for our health system to subsidize health education, and indeed it does. It keeps it afloat. It would not make sense to them or to the physicians who put 30% of their income into the educational mission to subsidize an undergraduate curriculum, and nor would it be financially feasible. They are right on the edge of being able to afford paying their own salaries, which they do. In addition, we're concerned that this legislation moves incredibly quickly, and it's easy to make light of that and say we're not interested in change, we're afraid of change. I don't think any institutions have changed in this state as much as these two institutions. We love it. It's exciting, it's exhilarating, we've grown tremendously in both cases in different ways. So this isn't about change. It's really about what is the impact of a fundamental structural change. And it's probably worth pointing out the public corporation we intensely studied for 5 years before we brought it to you. We developed proposals. We developed a spectrum of proposals. We analyzed them. We went around the country and analyzed other structures. We talked to business leaders in the community. We went all over the state and talked to every business, every chamber. We literally worked inside and outside the institution with the unions, with the Senate, and then brought forward in 1995 the proposal. It ended up passing by unanimous vote in one chamber and all but three in the other. It had very strong support from past and present governors and both parties. But there was an enormous amount of work that went into preparing that. And even so, and I was part of that team, we badly underestimated the amount of work it would take to implement it and pull it off, to manage a board that was governing in a completely new way. And so we spent the last decade really trying to figure that out and how to make that transition from a state agency to an entity that competes in a pretty fiercely competitive marketplace. We're frequently visited at OHSU by individuals from other systems, other states, trying to figure out how we've survived with so little investment per student, per research dollar brought in, per any metric you choose. And really, they're puzzled. The conclusion most draw when they analyze us is two or three things. One, focus, extreme focus. Two, a very united, integrated leadership team that had the same goal and thought their survival depended on that goal. While there's nominally a 10-year transition period in this bill, there's an immediate action, and that really needs to be very clear. Within 1 year, Portland State would be taken out of the higher ed system, and our board would then be governing, or a similar-looking board would then be governing the two institutions. That's a huge act. That isn't isn't a study, that isn't an analysis. That's action with no prior analysis. And I think, yes, we are fearful of that because we don't have any feasibility analysis. We don't know what the consequences of that would be. The transition period is intended to allow for the study of that, but it occurs after the act. And so it just seems backwards to those of us who've been through a transition somewhat like this. It does seem prudent to actually understand those issues first. Yes, it does take some additional time, but I think the product of a merger is challenging. There are a number of other concerns that we're just beginning to work through. With both our legal and financial folks, the capital markets are very important to us. A merged entity can really survive only if it has access to capital. That was probably the single biggest factor in the public corporation, was that we were able to access the debt market, renovate the hospital, and compete on the marketplace to bring in with modern equipment to bring in patients. If we can't reasonably project our cash, and that's the bottom line here, you have to be able to project your cash and your margins to access that capital and to meet your debt coverage requirements that are in your bond covenants, it puts us in jeopardy with our current bondholders. And we just don't know the answer to that yet, but it's something that our financial people are very concerned about. Your credit rating is also a very critical matter because of the financial risk that this portends, coupled with the reductions in state funding. We've been advised that the mere discussion is actually putting us at risk right now. So we're very worried about that, and I'm not afraid of change. I've embraced it. I've helped lead it, but this is a concern to us. So I apologize if I sound emotional, but it's a very serious issue here. Bondholder consent. We have covenants in the bond market right now. We have major promises, contractual promises to bondholders that we believe will have to be addressed before such a financial transaction could occur. And there's also transaction costs. We've been through a number of much, much smaller mergers over the past decade. They are expensive. They're worth it in some cases and not in others, but there's an investment required. And you don't immediately achieve savings by consolidation. We still have the same size ship to move forward here. And yes, you do achieve some consolidation in other positions, but you have to enhance systems. We had to develop all of our own systems. It does not immediately translate that capacity exists to assume an enormous institution with 25,000 students. So the transaction costs are both complex to even predict, but significant as you work through the financial, the legal, the IT system kinds of requirements to continue to perform at the excellent level in which both institutions are. To me, perhaps the most concerning of all this is the lack of planning and focus. The institutions have survived because they've had focused missions. Both of these institutions have been very successful at focusing their mission and doing it incredibly well. One can see in this bill an entirely understandable desire to replicate in Portland what's occurred in other cities, such as Seattle. I went to graduate school in Madison. In one city, much like Salem, you have the equivalent of U of O, OSU, and OHSU in one institution. UW has some of those same traits. It is a powerful thing. They have 100, 200-year histories behind them, 150-year histories behind them, though, that you can't ignore when you think about how you would bring this to pass here. To introduce a broad undergraduate curriculum to OHSU won't instantly create UW or a clone of it in Portland. We're worried, in fact, that the opposite might occur, that you might undermine that quality if you don't think about it, plan it, and invest in the kind of institution. If you look at UW, and we've done this for years, at the difference between UW, OHSU, and PSU, and UCSF and Cal Berkeley, the difference is investment. It's not organizational structure. We all have different organizational structures. They all work pretty well. The difference is the amount of investment that's occurred. There's been no feasibility study on this merger, as Dr. Greenlich pointed out. But what we have learned over the past is that OHSU and the state concluded that the health system didn't operate very efficiently, encumbered in a larger bureaucracy. We have in fact, thrived by being able to operate the health system in such a way that we can increase productivity. We've been able to carry an uncompensated load in patient care delivery far greater than is funded, and by the end of this session, essentially without funding against that. As a standalone academic health center without a large undergraduate population, we've had almost perfect synergy between our educational mission, our research mission, and our healthcare mission. And that I can't overemphasize that. One faculty member, one body, really delivers all three of those missions in most cases, or at least two of them. We have a very small endowment for an institution our size and rapidly reducing state funds. The state funds are less than 4% of our budget. We're able to do this. We're able to leverage this rather small funding base because of the focus on the mission. An example of the importance of this is UCSF. I was on the accrediting team for UCSF a few years ago when they were in the midst of the merger with the Stanford Health System. I don't know if you recall that system, but that merger didn't last very long. The cultures were just too different, and it unraveled at a cost of many millions of dollars. But it was not planned, and the culture difference wasn't taken into account. On the ground in the accrediting visit, it was obvious what was happening, and yet all the good things that you just heard were being said of that that marriage at the time, and they're laudable goals. There's nothing wrong with those as a long-term goal. In general, corporate mergers do work when there's a very strong will on the part of the parties and an understanding of the common goals and how you're going to accomplish those goals. Medical College of Virginia is an example you just heard. They merged in 1968, the Health Sciences Schools and the MCV Hospital and the Richmond Professional Institute of Liberal Arts. And the interesting thing about that, and some of our leadership's actually from that area, is that the goal there over 30 years ago was to take two colleges and create one. And under the new name Virginia Commonwealth University. Circumstances were quite different. Each had issues with accreditation. Neither of us currently have. But the promise of the merger was greatly enhanced state additional state investment. I don't assume that's likely to be the case here, although it would be lovely if it were. It's worth pointing out, though, that 30 years later, that merger has not fully taken hold. There's two distinct campuses, two separate foundations, disagreements with students, faculty, alumni about the improper use of the names, the logos, the various ways that you integrate two systems. So it's not a perfect marriage, and it doesn't mean there couldn't be one. It just means that the shotgun marriage concept doesn't always work very well with two institutions. Our merger with OGI is another interesting example. In 2001, we changed our name from Oregon Health Sciences University to Oregon Health and Science University. It had the advantage of keeping the acronym, which was helpful to us financially, but the fact is we changed that name with great thought and very great significance. Health and Science University means that we've viewed our role as broader than health sciences. But even with that merger, which merged and ended with 60 faculty to one with 2,000 to 3,000, it has been an enormous struggle. It's worth the struggle, and it's taken huge focus of the board and of the management to help it come together. And as you're probably aware, it's still sorting itself out. The basic computer science faculty have moved to Portland State. Those focused on health applications are now generating NIH grants and accomplishing what was envisioned in the original merger. But that's a tiny, tiny merger, and the amount of work that we all spent on every detail, every policy, every integration aspect is very significant. So I just would hope that it won't be the outcome of this discussion that the effort required to make a successful joining is underestimated. My colleague Mike Rudin will talk about the numerous partnerships we have in more detail. We already work together on many, many planes. I'm sure that will continue and will deepen as we go forward. There is tremendous complementarity in our at sciences in particular, and every chance we have, I think we should try and pull those together. Our plans to develop the South Waterfront were made very much more interesting and exciting to us because it's linked with the streetcar up to the Portland State campus. We very much want to see better integration of programs, research programs in particular, but the educational programs as well, and we'll continue to work to that end. We're very supportive, as I indicated, of the goal of strengthening higher ed in Portland and throughout the state. The irony here is that I just finished a morning before the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee talking about the 40% reduction that's proposed in the governor's budget. Cuts in the past few years to OHSU's budget have forced us to close or transfer many educational programs, to raise tuition, to reduce care for vulnerable populations. I think as a state we need to stabilize the funding of higher education and rather than, before doing that, consider such a risky move. So in conclusion, we're concerned about this bill because that while it's very well intended, it won't achieve the laudable goal of strengthening higher ed and might, in fact, have just the opposite effect. These institutions are very fragile financially. They've grown very rapidly. They're busy shoring up their infrastructure around very different missions right now. And to take such a precipitous step without a better understanding of the feasibility and the consequences is somewhat frightening, frankly, and we would very much hope you will be cautious and analyze this very carefully. Thank you very much for letting me speak to you today.
Thank you, Dr. Halleck. Dr. Rudin?
Thank you. Chair Flores, members of the committee. My name is Michael Reardon, and I was provost of Portland State from 1991 to 1999, and returned only in June of this year as interim provost, an appointment that ends on June 29th. So I mentioned I have no stake in whether my particular job as provost would go away or stay. I'm here, in fact, to speak to some of our concerns about House Bill 2560, but I would really like to begin by stating unequivocally that Portland State has enjoyed a long and positive relationship with Representative Greenland. And it's difficult, therefore, to disagree publicly with someone who's been a very good friend and colleague in our university. As Representative Greenland pointed out, he had joined the PSU faculty some time ago. He's credited, as both he and Provost Halleck have pointed, with the development of the joint PSU, OHSU, and OSU master's degree in public health program. He's also been a very strong advocate, as you heard today, of Portland State, and in fact he gets credit for being in a leadership role in forming the part-time faculty union on our campus. His commitment to Portland State is strong, and he's still actively involved, as he's mentioned to you, in terms of the Metropolitan Studies Board and the Judaic Studies Advisory Board. So it's somewhat regrettable that we find ourselves in a position of opposing this bill, and not because we do not support the concept of improving the quality and recognition of Portland State University, and certainly not because we don't want to support collaboration with Oregon Health and Science University. But the legislation proposes major structural changes in the governance of our university. We feel there's not been adequate discussion on our campus involving our colleagues and those at Oregon Health Sciences University to provide either Representative Greenlick or others with an analysis of how the university would transition to a public corporation, how much that transition would cost, what systems would be needed at Portland State in order to separate us from the Oregon University system. The bill would, in fact, do several things: move Portland State to the status of a public corporation, remove Portland State from the Oregon University system, but maintain an affiliation for the purposes of approving academic programs, establishing a new board of directors for the two institutions, and ultimately the idea of planning for the merger. We have not really had time to conduct a thorough analysis of the impact these changes would have on PSU. We are certain there would be costs associated with the public corporation change and the creation of a new board and planning for the merger. Additionally, we are unable to provide at this point any idea specifically what the costs or timelines for Portland State would need to become such a public corporation. However, on the basis of the experience of OHSU, as Professor Halleck has pointed out, they required a 5-year planning period to implement that change, and we suspect that a timeline like that would be similar for us. Though we at this point do not see the need for the merger with OHSU, we certainly wholeheartedly endorse Representative Greenwick's goal of improving the quality and national rankings of Portland State. We also support the goal of developing programmatic and research collaborations with Oregon Health and Science University. In order to be successful in these efforts, we believe that the state would need to make major funding commitments to both institutions. And it is hard for us to imagine in ways which we could spend the next year preparing for such a move and move to a public corporation, while at the same time we are trying successfully to manage the effect of budget reductions in our general fund budget for the coming biennium. Our promise to the OSU board, to the governor, and to the legislature is we would not complain about the challenges we face as a result of reduced state funding, but in exchange we have respectively asked that no unfunded mandates be directed to us. Portland State has already been working with the legislature and others on building programs of national ranking that can move us ahead as a comprehensive university in Portland. While the state funding has been limited, it is necessary to recognize that where we have made targeted investments, that the impact of these investments have had a significant role in enhancing Portland State's regional and national reputation. As a few examples of this, we are very proud of the fact that we have moved in the rankings in U.S. News and World Report in the categories of internships, cooperative learning, learning communities, and community-based learning into the very top rank of American universities. We also recognize that our schools of urban studies and planning and social work are among the nationally ranked schools in this area. We also have received very significant recognition within the top 25 schools in delivering an MBA program in distance delivery and online. We are currently seeing the emergence of a world-class transportation system laboratory and a university transportation center. We also have been designated by the U.S. National Security Agency as a center of academic excellence, primarily because of our expanded work in computer science and the areas of computer security. These rankings and evaluations I mentioned to demonstrate that where we have been given the resources to invest, we actually have been able to advance the reputation and the significance of the university itself. I'd also like to speak a little bit about the partnerships that exist between Portland State and Oregon Health and Science Universities. These examples highlight the work of both institutions and what we are doing under tight physical constraints to build excellence. I would also point out that these have occurred naturally and without the need for a formal legislative mandate or merger. Our goal is to further enhance these partnerships and build more where the interests of both institutions can be met. These initiatives are successful because they have emerged from faculty collaborations more strongly than they in fact have been mandated. We have many partnerships in research areas of mutual strength. These include work on intelligent robotics, ways to design and implement computer support systems, managing and processing large amounts of data, computer security, biometrics, and signal isolation for functional neurosurgery, mental health, geriatric issues, areas of the treatment and study of alcoholism, nanoscience, bioscience, and more. The two universities have several programmatic connections. We've already mentioned the Master in Public Health program. Faculty from Portland State's Massey College of Engineering and Computer Science work closely with the faculty from OHSU and OGI School of Engineering. We have linked library resources and are partners in the Portland Research and Education Network, which provides Internet2 capacity to the region. PSU and OHSU faculty have upheld appointments at both institutions. there has been a long-standing tradition between the institutions and include faculty in the sciences, social sciences, and professional schools. We have recently successfully recruited a new chair of our chemistry department, Dr. Kevin Reynolds, who works in the area of biological synthesis of chemical compounds used in pharmacology. And we were able to attract Professor Reynolds and his significant research projects to Portland State because of his already existing relationships with OHSU. These are just some of the examples of ways that we are and have worked together. And another important collaboration is between our undergraduate pre-health profession programs and the Oregon Health Sciences University. We have had consistently a very large number of students who are admitted to medical, dental, and nursing programs there every year. Again, Portland State and OHSU have in effect built a strong partnership. We did it without formal legislation or structural mandates. The beneficiaries of this relationship are our faculty, our students, and the community. And more certainly needs to be done and encouraged, and to be encouraged. And we would welcome the legislature's financial support for our programs and what is, in fact, intended to be achieved by the bill that's being proposed. We feel, though, that one of the fundamental weaknesses of the bill is the assumption that removing Portland State from the Oregon University system, establishing a new board and merging the two institutions, is guaranteed to work. OHSU has already discussed problems associated with other mergers of this type, as well as the challenges that they have faced in the merger with OGI. The only part of the House bill that isn't mandated within the next 2 years is the merger of the two institutions. Under this bill, PSU would leave the Oregon State system and report to a new board within the beginning of a year. If for some reason the merger didn't happen down the road and no new funds were available to Portland State, we would be in a very challenging place and find it difficult to meet the needs of a rapidly growing student population. Furthermore, we would be in direct conflict with OHSU for resources allocated to the Portland Metropolitan Universities Board. Finally, the legislation is silent on the funding needed to fulfill Representative Greenleaf's goals and objectives. There are comparisons made between Portland and Seattle all the time. The comparisons between PSU and the University of Washington must begin by looking at resources and state funding. The University of Washington is significantly larger in terms of programs and students served, and certainly significantly larger in terms of direct state support. Building the University of Washington in Portland will take more than merging the two institutions. It would take substantial amounts of funding. Conclusion, I can say that once PSU is divorced from the Oregon University system, we may find that this solution has been expensive, difficult, and everlasting. These changes in governance, in order to be successful, must really involve faculty and staff in a lot more discussion and development of the decision-making process, and be very carefully and well planned with an awareness of what it would cost to actually support and make this a successful transition. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you, Dr. Reardon. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you both very much. For our final presenters today, and we will be rescheduling two participants who will be giving testimony, but I'd like to call forward Larry Crenshaw and Niles Lehman.
Chair Flores and members of the committee, for the record, I am Larry Crenshaw, professor of biology at Portland State University, and Niles Lehman is chemistry there. We found out about this hearing yesterday. Well, I found out yesterday. I called Niles at about 11:15, and we were so excited that we felt we had to testify. I've thought about this, and I just think it's a really fantastic opportunity, and I'm surprised we haven't taken it into account before. I have the most respect for Dr. Halleck and Dr. Reardon, and they have both presided over an amazing increase in the probably the reputation and the ranking of both universities, particularly OHSU. That's been really wonderful to see. But we've also come a long way. When I got here, I was sort of a superstar. Every single year I've been at Portland State for 22 years, I've had large federal grants averaging about $100,000. Relative to Representative Roblin, in addition to the $100,000, $41,000 comes to the state of Oregon, and there are very few strings on that. They must be, because I never see it. But it goes somewhere. And probably Dr. Halleck has a better idea. But those are very important funds. So it isn't just what is specified to my laboratory is indeed extremely tightly controlled, but the other isn't. So to the extent we could increase federal funds, we would have a great increase in flexibility for the educational system. I think the system would do that. I think it's critical that the major metropolitan area have the absolute strongest possible presence of higher education and economic development, cultural experiences, and particularly for the well-being of the citizens and our children. We really have to, if there's anything we can do to increase the strength in this area, we have to do it. What qualifications do I have? First of all, I have real faculty appointments, both at OHSU and at Portland State, and I've been on the faculty at medical schools where they have associated medical schools and undergraduate education, Columbia University and Yale. I was on the faculty there. Columbia is a good parallel institution because the College of Physicians and Surgeons is 168th Street. You jump on the IRT and you go down, and then about 116th Street is where the lower campus is. And in many ways it's similar, and they don't have, there's griping now and then, and it's like, how come medical money goes to ballet? But the point is, it's valued. They have a huge value in undergraduate artistic experience, and to a slight extent, the medical school underwrites us. And I don't think any of us in the medical school that had grants felt bad about this. We were proud that it supported other disciplines. I'm hoping the bill means, I think it does. I don't think there's any indication that we're going to become a technical school. I think that the undergraduate experience would be strengthened. And both my undergraduate education at UCLA and my postdoctoral experience at UCSD involved schools with medical and undergraduate curricula, and it worked very, very well. Okay, why is reputation important? Why is ranking important? Because many times when you're applying for grants, there's a checkoff on institutional support, and one of the things they look at is the activity in the school, and by combining, that's an automatic increase in that. A lot of the ranking is done sort of mindlessly. It's easy to punch numbers into computers, so they punch in, well, what are the federal funds, how many publications, and it's pretty straightforward that we would increase our capabilities by adding those together. No question about that. What does it do if you increase your rankings? It's really important that the quality of people you bring, the faculty, but also grad students. Grad students, they're not dumb. They're looking at, what's the ranking of the institution? How well can I get a job when I get out? And it's real obvious with athletic teams. Those coaches go nuts trying to recruit people in. It's not as obvious in an academic institution, but we can't put out something better than what comes in. And so the graduate students often stay in the area. This is what we provide to Intel and other industries. In our labs, the intellect level they bring in, the work ethic, and their training are critical. And the higher the ranking you have, the better people you will bring in. And I think OHSU is now bringing in a very high quality of people, and so are we. And so I think it really is fair to say it'd be more of a merger than a subsuming. I think that we're both providing a really good product. Okay, so how do you accomplish something like this? One way, that was occurring when I was at UC San Diego during my postdoc. They went from nothing to a very highly ranked university, but it was a huge amount of money. And they built new buildings, brought in some of the best faculty in the country. A couple of my really good friends were in the medical school class, and there they did it, but we don't have that. So how do we do it? And the first thing is just to use the wits to come up with an opportunity. What can we see that we could do that wouldn't be extremely expensive? The second is just to have the verve and the work ethic and the bravery to give it a go. Let's have at it. And we start slowly, and you make sure that there are provisions to make corrective adjustments, but you do start. It's important to start. This has been sitting around way too long. It's way too valuable of an opportunity to just put down. Some of the things I've read about cultural problems, I don't see that. All the medical schools I was at were completely different, even in the way they chose their chairs. That's usually appointed in a medical school. Typically, it's elected in an undergraduate college, but there's differences. But it didn't matter. They kept their institutions. They kept their cultural sensitivities. Actually, if you look at the differences in culture between, say, biology and chemistry and English and music, those differences are far greater than, say, the difference between chemistry and biology and pharmacology. We were talking about this on the way down. We have similar cultures. It's got more to do with really the intellectual arena than it does with the institution. And what about costs? Yeah, it's because I don't think we should look at this as saving money. We should just look at it as a tremendous opportunity. There will be costs, but on the other hand, there's some overlap, probably not as much as people might think, because you're still going to have to do this at both places, and in many cases it takes a certain number of people to do it, so you can't just reduce the number of people. But there's a lot of things that will be offset. The libraries, in many ways, could augment each other much. They work together now, but not as well. A lot of things are going in the electronic direction. In that sense, we could really benefit at Portland State from some of the access to journals that is available at the medical school. So overall, I would just like to thank you. I'm so glad I came here, because I've been very impressed with the legislature and how things work, and I've been frightfully ignorant of that. So that alone has been a good education to me. So thank you for listening to me, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Crawshaw, and I apologize for not pronouncing. I managed to slay both of your names as I brought
sounds
you forward.
Good to me.
So my apologies. A couple of quick questions, and then we'll move to Dr. Lehman.
You said that it's been sitting around for far too long. Have you been aware of some sort of movement to put the two together for some time?
Yeah, actually, Chairperson and Representative Dahlem, I think it was before 5 years ago, they had a session at the university club where they brought in 20 or 30 people, and we were asked, what do you think about this? And I happened to be there because I have affiliations with both universities, and at the time, I was one of the few. I said, we need to merge. The sooner the better. And so clearly they were looking at that. And also we have been looking at how good is OUS, or is this right for PSU? It is not at all true that we haven't thought about it. That's been thought about. It's just that to do it actually is a big step. So this was 4 or 5 years ago. And at the time I said, we need to do this. We should call it the Oregon University and move on with it. But I was in the minority.
Madam Chair, a follow-up, please.
Very quick follow-up. We're on a real short leash. I've just been invited.
I'm late coming. Anyway, if there was something, do you have any idea why nothing came of this? Why it laid on the table?
Well, it's extremely difficult. And anybody that's done anything knows that problems are far more difficult. It always seems easier than it will be, and I have no doubts that this will be difficult. And Dr. Halleck represented, I think she's right. It's hard, but I think you can either decide that it's hard and not do it, or you can say, well, it will be difficult, but we're going to go ahead. So it's a hard undertaking.
Thank you very much.
One quick one, Representative.
My comment is, there's only one Fortune 500 company in Portland, and I know that you're not a business professor, but don't you believe that this would open up opportunities for us to increase the potential?
Oh, clearly. The economic opportunity is absolutely there, and they need to see that there's a major, exciting, ranked research university, comprehensive research university, particularly for their kids and for employees. That's absolutely critical. No question about it. I don't want to take away.
For the record, please give us your name and then you may.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, thank you for letting us testify. My name is Niles Lehman. I'm a professor of chemistry at Portland State University. I've been there about 4 years, and I've taught it in three different states now at three different institutions, and I'm very happy to be at Portland State. And I've never done anything like this before, testifying in front of a state or a Senate committee of any sort. But this particular initiative is so creative, bold, and forward-thinking that I had to come down here and put my two cents in, and I won't take up a lot of your time because a lot of the things that have been said already today have covered the things that I was going to say. I just want to add two things. One is that I think that this initiative would be beneficial for the City of Portland, the State of Oregon, both institutions, and something that hasn't been mentioned, the students at these universities in the long run, because having a more prestigious university means that their degree is worth more, okay? And when they go out in the marketplace, if they have a degree from a very prestigious university, it carries more weight. My graduate degree was from UCLA, and it was in the hard sciences, but the fact that UCLA had a world class ballet school, film school, management school, business school, these sorts of things lended weight to the degree, and I think that that's something that hasn't really been talked about. The other thing that hasn't come up as much, although Larry touched on it, is the ability of both of the institutions to increase their share of the federal grant funding situation, which is highly competitive these days as the federal government cuts funds to the National Science Foundation, as they cut funds to NASA, which are two of the institutions that I get my funding from, and push these funds more towards the National Institute of Health, NIH. It becomes increasingly difficult for faculty members to generate federal dollars for the research, which brings overhead money to the university and the state. Having a more prestigious university means that your grant proposals are going to be viewed in a better light, and it enhances your ability to get those highly competitive funds, and I think would push the overall stature of both the universities forward. So thank you very much for allowing us to testify, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. And because of the press of time, I understand they must turn the room, if you will. We will be having another public hearing on this Monday, February 28th. And if you would like to come down and expand on your testimony, we'd love to have you do that. My apologies, Dr. Pernstenter and Ms. Higgins. We hope that you will come back and join us. I know that you have points of view that we want to hear as well. And before I close the public hearing on this, I just am mindful of something, a few words and ideas that I've heard in regard to being unworkable. I'm sure the Wright brothers heard that about their idea, their vision, and their boldness as well. So, with that, the public hearing is closed on House Bill 2560. Members of the committee, I would just like to remind you that we will be gathering tomorrow for a joint field hearing at Wilson High School. We will not be meeting on Friday, February 25, and we will not be meeting on Friday, March 4th. So you've got two Fridays free. Make the most of it. And nothing further, other than the fact that any discussions, because I think the new participants in the following segment are going to be coming in, we might take any conversations we have to the outer hall. This committee is adjourned. Thank you.